This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio.
Final seconds. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
From the Quicken Loan Studios in Houston, Texas, here's your host, 6'1", former Oklahoma Sooner basketball player, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Well, welcome in tonight to the all-new SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. I'm your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell, going to be with you over the next 2 hours. And I tell you what, big-time changes have taken place since I've been on vacation. I am so excited to be back and gearing up for the start of a brand-new college football season. Of course, in a few weeks, we will be set for kickoff. And tonight, you know what, we're going to open up our very first show on SB Nation Radio. We're going to head out to the SEC and shine the spotlight on the Auburn Tigers and provide a complete 2016 preview. And we're also going to walk down memory lane. We're going to take a look back at some of the most memorable moments in program's history and a gentleman who has been there every step of the way. He is amazing. Delighted to have with us on the Progressive Insurance Celebrity Guest Line, that is Rod Bramblett. He is the lead announcer for Auburn Football Broadcast and just released his new book, Touchdown Auburn, Carrying on the Tradition of the Auburn Tigers. Welcome to SB Nation Radio, Rod.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you.
We're excited about this visit and, of course, to highlight your new book. But first and foremost, I know Tiger fans, they're anxious to get your perspective. Give us the pulse on the Tigers and what we can expect this season, because how optimistic are you that you guys will be better than that disappointing 7-6 season last year?
You know, I think the way the season ended last year was big. A bowl game win in Birmingham, I think it kind of I get catapulted Auburn into the off season, and I think, you know, Auburn typically, for whatever reason, does better when those expectations are a little bit low, and obviously they're lower than most would like. But when I look and I've been out practice several times, you know, listen, Gus Malzahn is a great offensive mind, and he's among the best out there. But I tell you, when I watch this team, I think the strength's going to be its defense. I mean, it has a chance to be as good as it's been in 9 or 10 years. They're deep across the defensive line. Secondary should be among the best in the SEC. So I think you have to start there with this Auburn football team. And then over on the offensive side, you look at Gus's track record, and last year offensively, Auburn was not that great. So you look at his track record, and it's hard for me to believe that you'll go 2 years in a row and see Auburn's offense sputter like it did last year.
Well, Rod, what about the impact of losing their starting running back in Javon Robinson and after his dismissal? Can you kind of give us some insight on perhaps what happened there?
Well, I think it was just a case of a young man not following the rules. I'm not sure, and I really don't know all the details. I really don't, so I don't want to speak out of turn, but the impression I get is a young man that just didn't meet the standards. I think Coach Malzahn and his staff, after a disappointing year last year, said, listen, we're not going to have any distractions. No distractions. We're all going to be on the same page. And, for Javon, I don't think he ever was quite on that same page. I think he had some opportunities to get back in the good graces. But at the end of the day, they just felt like, you know, we can't let whatever is going on linger any longer into practice. We're getting ready for a football season here. We've got to be on the same page. So, I don't know if it was one thing or a multitude of things. But, you know, for Gus Malzahn to make a statement, that's a statement. When you cut loose the guy that, you know, on the depth chart going into the season is going to be your number one guy, you make a statement by cutting him loose, that's, you know, that says something about the direction you want to go. And that you know, you truly don't want any distractions. You want everybody moving in the same direction. And I think that was the case there.
We are so glad you're with us at the all-new SB Nation Radio. You're listening to the Big E Sports Show and the voice of the Auburn Tigers. He's the author of his new book, Touchdown Auburn, Carrying on the Tradition of the Auburn Tigers. We're going to get into that here momentarily as we continue to go one-on-one with Rod Bramblett. And you're talking about Javon Robinson, his dismissal. I mean, so who's going to step in and fill his shoes? I mean, what kind of depth do they have at the running back position, Rod?
Yeah, it does hurt a little bit. It certainly does, because Javon was an SEC caliber running back. He showed flashes of it last season. But I tell you, waiting in the wings is a young man from up in North Alabama, the Huntsville area, by the name of Kerryon Johnson. He is a you know, I don't know how many of your listeners remember Carnell Williams from back in 2003, 2004, mm-hmm. but he's that kind of running back. I mean, he's a guy that can make you miss. I'm not sure I would call him a power back, but he's got the ability to break tackles, and he has breakaway speed. I think he's the next in line, but they also have a couple of others, and a kid by the name of Cameron Petway, who's a big, strong, physical kid. He's probably he's closer to being a fullback than he is a tailback, but he's probably a little undersized to be a fullback. He's a guy, and I was watching him the other day at scrimmage. He's a guy that when Auburn gets inside the 5-yard line, there's no reason for them not to score six. He's a guy that's not going backwards. He goes forward, and he's a real power back. And they have a couple of freshmen as well. A kid by the name of Cam Martin, who was a late addition from Baylor after they went through their situation. And Malik Miller is also another freshman. We'll see how they play into it. But, you know, in this league, you better have three, if not four, guys you can lean on because it's such a physical league. And I think, you know, while the margin of error is certainly smaller now for Auburn at that position, I think they're in pretty good shape.
Hey, we're zeroing in on the Auburn Tigers. We're going to talk about Rod Bramblett's brand-new book, Touchdown Auburn, carrying on the tradition of the Auburn Tigers here in just a moment. So break down the schedule. They hardly ease into the season. They open up, from what I understand, September 3rd against Clemson. I mean, are you kidding me?
Well, you look at the only good thing about Auburn's schedule.
Is what?
Is they start with their first five games at home. I mean,
that's nice.
You know, that is a good thing. You start the season with the defending national runner-up. You finish the season at the defending national champion with Alabama. And in between, you get LSU and Texas A&M at your place. That's good. But you have to go to Ole Miss. You have to go to Georgia. And as I mentioned, you go to Alabama. It's as tough a schedule as I can remember. And you know, even, gosh, I think second week of the season, it's Arkansas State. And you go, well, that's an easy win. And it probably should be a win, but Arkansas State is favored to win the Sun Belt Conference, so they're certainly a quality opponent. It's a brutal, brutal schedule, but thank goodness the first five are at home. The first three are at night, which Auburn always plays better at home at night. So, you know, there's some things in Auburn's favor, but you know, there's no doubting the schedule is just brutal.
It's such an honor to have with us right here at SB Nation Radio, the voice of the Auburn Tigers. Hey, he does it all. He's the play-by-play voice for not only football, basketball, and baseball. Rod, you must have a great wife.
Well, bless her heart. She's my high school sweetheart. We've been married 27 years coming up
in
a few weeks, and we have two wonderful kids. And you know, the best thing about my home life is that no one in my house, not my wife, not my 17-year-old daughter, not my 12-year-old son, really could give a rip about sports. So it's great to be able to come home.
Uh-huh.
It's great to be able to come home and not, you know, you don't have to live it when you get home after a tough loss, you know. So she's wonderful. But, you know, I get to do what I love to do. It's something I've always wanted to do. And to be able to do it for my alma mater makes it even more special.
Oh, so let's transition and let's highlight your new book titled Touchdown Auburn, carrying on the tradition of the Auburn Tigers. And I tell you what, it is jam-packed with so many memorable moments, and we will never forget the 2013 Iron Bowl as the Auburn Tigers executed one of the most remarkable plays in college football history. I know exactly where I was when that play went down and I listened to the call. It was awesome, Rod.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, that play was I guess the catalyst for the publishing company giving me a call and about 6 months afterwards and saying, hey, you should write a book about
just one more thing to do.
yeah, just write a book about, and they were I think initially were thinking, all right, write a book about the amazing Georgia finish 2 weeks before, and then of course the Alabama finish that you just mentioned. And I just flat out told them, I said, listen, you're not gonna get a book out of that. And I said, I'm not even sure if I can write a book.
Yeah.
So, you know, I sat and pondered it for about 9 months, and initially I just did not want to do it. But my wife, who couldn't give a rip about sports, finally told me. She said, listen, you will regret not doing this one day. And she said, what better time to do it? So the approach I took was, hey, it's not going to be an autobiography. It's going to be a collection of memories and stories and columns and things that I felt like the Auburn fans would enjoy reading, reliving moments, seeing what's happening behind the scenes at some of these amazing games. And you know what? It was a chore, but it was very rewarding once it was done.
It is titled Touchdown Auburn, carrying on the tradition of the Auburn Tigers from our good friends, the publisher at Triumph Books. Congratulations, Rod, on the book. And we look forward to open invitation. We would love to have you back. We can talk some more about the book and, of course, getting the pulse on your Tigers. Okay?
Anytime. My pleasure.
You bet. Stick around. Much more coming your way right here in hour number one at SB Nation Radio.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Alyssa Walker-Campbell, I want to welcome you back to SB Nation Radio. And the conversation continues with some off-season NBA news and notes, specifically the Los Angeles Lakers. We are delighted to have back with us Mark Medina, the LA Daily News Lakers beat writer. We're going to talk about some of these bold moves the Lakers made in the offseason. And also, we're going to debate, well, you know, what's the future of the Lakers? Welcome back, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me on, as always.
Okay, so last time you were on the show, we talked about how the Lakers, they closed out that miserable season with Kobe Bryant capping off that incredible 60-point performance. But I want you to get us up to date on what were the offseason priorities for the Lakers, and, you know, were they able to deliver on that goal, Mark?
Well, I think you kind of have to break it down into two different areas. They were able to deliver on the goal when it came to their draft needs. There wasn't much of a debate who they were going to select at number two. They chose Brandon Ingram. It was a natural fit because they needed someone to man that small forward spot, and he brings a lot of qualities that the Lakers lacked last season, including outside shooting and a defensive presence on the wing. But as far as everything else, you know, the Lakers made do of the best of circumstances, but they were really hoping that they would at least have a chance at Kevin Durant. And, you know, the Lakers were in such bad shape that Kevin Durant didn't even grant them a meeting. Basically, he didn't want to waste their time. He was targeting teams that wound up being the Golden State Warriors because that team gave him the best chance to win an NBA title. So the Lakers immediately shifted gears to Plan B, where they try to get some of their second-tier free agents, you know, guys like Lou Alding and Timofey Mozgov. They re-signed Jordan Clarkson, one of their young pieces. You know, it's not going to change things overnight, but I think it provides some established veteran presence that wasn't always there last year. They had some veterans, as you mentioned, with Kobe Bryant, whose stature speaks for itself, but he was always in and out of the lineup because of his injuries. And then they had someone like Metta World Peace, who was a very accomplished player, but he's at the tail end of his career and didn't really have much of a playing role. So I think the hope for this offseason is, you know, they can just continue establishing continuity with that young core and then add some veteran pieces in that mix that would provide both good locker room influence and some production on the floor. But whether that's going to be enough to make some noise in the playoff appearance, I think that's asking a lot, just considering the fact that they finished last season with their worst record in franchise history with only 17 wins.
LA Daily News and Lakers beat writer Mark Medina is with us at the all-new SB Nation Radio. Connect with us online at Twitter at @eradiosports. And you know, Mark, you were just talking about the addition of Timofey Mozgov. I mean, did this move make sense? I mean, do the Lakers overpay for him? And can he return to his pre-knee surgery 2015 form?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely overpaid. And part of it is by circumstance. Part of it is, you know, they may have just overdone it. But a lot of it, you have to put into context with this new labor deal, all these television revenue increased the salary cap. And then the Lakers, where they are as a franchise, they're not a good team. And when you want to get some decent players, you will always have to overpay. And I think the fact that they immediately targeted Timofey Mozgov showed that the Lakers were ready to move on to Plan B, and they targeted a specific area of need. They needed a starting center because they didn't have any plan to keep Roy Hibbert. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of needs that they have to address in terms of the talent pool, but that was the biggest priority. Whether he can be a dominant force before his injury last year, that remains to be seen. But Timofey Mozgov told me in an interview shortly after agreeing to a deal with the Lakers that he's 100% healed. So whether he faces some limitations next season, it won't be health related. But, you know, I expect him to have a bounce back year. He is going to be the starting center, and I know that Lakers coach Luke Walton promised him that he will have a prominent role on the team.
What are your expectations of Brandon Ingram, the second overall pick, and perhaps you know, the biggest concern about him?
Well, I think that he's going to be a solid player. He checks off a lot of boxes. He has a long wingspan. He's very versatile. He's a good outside shooter, a very effective defender. I think we saw in summer league that he wasn't afraid of going up against some of the more physical players than he was used to during his lone freshman season at Duke. But obviously, that's going to be the main concern. He is rail thin, and will he be pushed around in the NBA? That's certainly going to be an adjustment, but at the same time, I don't think the Lakers are overly worried about his weight. They want it to fill out naturally. He is only 18 years old, so it's inevitable he's going to get stronger in the weight room, and he's going to change his diet. And I think by virtue of his position, he's playing in the wing. He's not going to be a post player where he has to defend a very big power forward, and he doesn't have to handle the ball a lot of times on offense. So some of those weaknesses can be masked because of his role, but whether that's going to be effective enough to win Rookie of the Year or be a member on the NBA All-First Team, it remains to be seen. A lot of these young players go through ups and downs, especially in their rookie season. But I think if nothing else, he's expected to be a solid contributor, you know, probably both as a starter and as a bench reserve.
It's our NBA offseason news and notes. We're zeroing in on the Los Angeles Lakers, visiting with Mark Medina from the LA Daily News, Lakers beat writer. And of course, Luke Walton inherits a 17-65 team. He will not have the talent that he had coaching the Warriors. How quickly can this team develop into a contender under his leadership?
You know, that's the intriguing question, but that's the uncertain question. By no means can they really duplicate what Golden State has with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala. But I think Luke Walton's hope is that he can carry over some of those qualities that they've executed as a team into the Lakers. So I think they're going to be preaching a lot about ball movement, spacing the floor, utilizing the three-point shot, and how well they do that obviously depends on their personnel and how quickly they can develop. But they can certainly try to emulate those qualities as much as possible. But I think the sense that from what Luke's message is, it's not going to be about wins and losses. It's going to be about the process and how quickly a lot of these young players develop. And I think that makes it for an exciting season, because I don't think many people, including even Laker fans, are really expecting them to make the playoffs. So I think the expectations are, let's see how these guys develop. But that also, I think, creates some angst, because it is the Lakers. They want to rebuild as quickly as possible. And it's not really clear at this point with the majority of their players, either second-year players, third-year players, or rookies. It's not clear how long that process is going to take and how many steps forward they will take within a single season before possibly taking some steps backwards during that process.
You know, it's interesting. Luke Walton went to the Rams training camp to learn from Jeff Fisher. So, I mean, Mark, what kind of strategies do you think he was looking for?
You know, I think that Luke Walton is one of those guys who's always eager to learn. And even if it's not necessarily Jeff Fisher can provide tips on how to maximize talent from a basketball standpoint, I'm sure that he has a lot of qualities that he can offer just as a coach. And that kind of really captures Luke Walton in a nutshell, where he's an avid learner. He's come from a very strong background where he has a lot of good mentors in his life. He played for a Hall of Fame coach at Arizona and Lute Olson. He played for a Hall of Fame coach with the Lakers and Phil Jackson. He learned under Steve Kerr with the Golden State Warriors. And I think because of all those influences, he's really eager to kind of meld those philosophies together and try to apply it to his personnel. And then from a personality standpoint, he's a very laid-back, easy-to-get-along-with kind of guy. And I think he's going to try to infuse a lot of joy into practices, where it's certainly going to be competitive and he's going to hold people accountable, but he's going to try to, you know, bring some lightheartedness to kind of break up the monotony of a long NBA schedule and to also create a very positive atmosphere.
We are short on time, been going one-on-one with LA Daily News and Lakers beat writer Mark Medina. We look forward to another conversation. Much more I want to get into. Russell Westbrook and also Derek Fisher. Will he ever be back in the NBA again? Much more, okay?
Okay, I'll keep my eyes and ears open for those two developments.
Sounds good. Much more coming your way right here in hour number one.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, Hey, welcome back to SB Nation Radio. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell, and we are so glad you're with us right here in hour number one of the Big E Sports Show. Of course, all of our interviews tonight are being brought to you by our good friends at Progressive Insurance. Comparing rates to help you save, now that's progressive. And the Rio 2016 Olympics, they are underway. And so in our next segment at SB Nation Radio, we're going to focus on women's soccer. Women's soccer, of course, became an Olympic sport in 1996. And Team USA have very high hopes after winning the World Cup last summer in Canada. Back with us on our program is longtime New York Times columnist George Vesey. He's here to dissect and break it all down. Welcome to SB Nation Radio.
Good evening. Always nice to talk to you.
It's wonderful to have you back with us. And so much excitement because the Olympics are here. What are your early takeaways and some of those top highlights?
Well, my early takeaway is, it's very different to be back home in the U.S. of A. while they're playing. It was so much fun. I covered seven Summer Olympics,
right,
from 1984 through 2008 in Beijing. And it was always great to me as a writer, a reporter, to be on the ground. For those of you who can get the New York Times website, of course, I'm not writing for it, but we have so many great people down there in Rio this time. And some of the writers are giving you the sense of what it's like out on the streets. And interestingly enough, I just read in the Times that the viewing attendance is down by 20% from 2012 in London to now. And that has nothing to do, because the time zone is favorable. Rio is, like 1 hour off for us on the East Coast. And people just aren't watching the same way. Now, I don't know whether that's the state of the world, but the idea of who's watching and who's paying attention. On the other hand, there are great things to watch. I, as a soccer buff, particularly love to watch the women's soccer. The men don't have a team, have not had a team in this one. They didn't qualify. But the women, our women, American women, are so good, and yet they had a hard time in the end of the first round, just getting out of it, just by surviving it. And other nations, the upgrade in tactics and skill in the years. I mean, we talk about the great years, and you know, it wasn't that long ago to me, of Mia Hamm and all those great players, Julie Foudy, coming along in the 90s. And yet that's, at least a generation ago. What I see from the women today, the football, the soccer that they are playing, is a huge upgrade in tactics and in skill and aggressiveness. They know more things to do with the ball, more little tricks, maybe even a little bit more diving and gamesmanship, but they have raised the level, and that's not patronizing. It's so much fun to watch great athletes who now can fake one way, go the other way, and you say, yeah, I bet you they couldn't do that 20 years ago. But it's a cumulative effort, and I would give the United States a lot of credit for that. These are the, let's say the daughters of Title IX, or even the granddaughters of Title IX, who are just getting better and better every time you look at them.
Best-selling author and longtime columnist with the New York Times, George Vesey, is back with us right here at the all-new SB Nation Radio. And with all that being said, I mean, I'm curious, George, what are your expectations for Team USA, specifically with women's soccer? I mean, they're seeking their fourth straight gold medal. Are they your favorite to be the top team standing on the podium in Rio?
Well, it's how they're playing Sweden in the quarterfinals, and it's hard to say. The teams are getting better. I mean, the other day, playing Colombia in a game that the U.S. basically needed, at least only a tie to get through, maybe even a 1-0 loss would have worked, and they had a hard time. A player named Esme, whom I didn't know, for Colombia, which never even had a team until like a generation ago, because in Colombia, football was always seen as something unfeminine, and the very macho society didn't want women playing the sport. In one generation, they have picked up the same skill and aggression of the men from Colombia in playing the sport, and this young woman hit two of the most amazing free kicks. One of them went through the legs of Hope Solo, the great, probably the greatest American keeper ever. Solo couldn't handle it. It took a little skip, and it got through the wickets. Amazing. And the other one was an angled free kick that went into the far corner, in the upper far corner. Just an amazing shot. And patronizing it may sound, but for a woman to take that kind of shot, particularly from a team that didn't even have a nation, that didn't even have a team, 10, 12 years ago, it's just amazing. So the more the merrier, And I think the United States is going to have a hard time staying in that top level as the Colombias and the Brazils start to shed that, you know, masculine, any woman who plays is less of a woman, blah, 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 blah. And now they're coming up with the same power and tactics that the men have had over the decades.
You know, so many brand new faces for USA. And I think about, you know, Coach Jill Ellis. You know, that's a lot for her to manage. Does this team seem to have a different feel and look? I mean, you're talking about a total of 11 newcomers on this roster, and they had massive losses after the retirement of Abby Wamick and Lauren Holiday after last year's triumph in Canada.
Well, I don't want to seem brutally honest about it. In the same week that A-Rod was given his walking papers, you know, as a player by the Yankees, you know, basically they just said, A-Rod, we can't use you anymore, and he got the hint, so to speak. The U.S. was, you could say, overdue, but they took a lot of older players. They earned it, of course. I mean, you don't cut an Abby Wambach. She means far more to the U.S. team than A-Rod does to the Yankees. But nevertheless, there were players who really were past their prime. And Abby would be the first example of it. She wasn't a full 90-minute player anymore by the last World Cup. So when you make those changes, I mean, they have two players in this team this year, Crystal Dunn, who comes not far from me on Long Island, college woman now playing professionally, and she is just a mobile player. And on the other side, they have an 18-year-old named Mallory Pugh, who's starting at Stanford. You know, nice to be young and just starting in college again.
Sure.
But thinking about it. And these two young women are just terrific, and they've had to wait their chance. I mean, Pugh wasn't ready maybe a year ago, but Dunn was. She was the last cut, and now they're ready. And, of course, my favorite player these days, maybe one of my favorite women players of all time, is Megan Rapinoe, who is just such a beautiful presence on the field, you know, with that thatch of light hair, and she's a ballerina out there, but she is also fearless. She came in, she's been hurt, and she played the first 30 minutes of the game against Colombia, and she looked rusty, and I don't know that she's ready to go, you know, 45 minutes or who knows what. But all of a sudden, the passes that were coming from her, you know, she was threading the needle, getting the ball in between seams of players. And you could just say that's why I love her, because she'll just take chances and do things that will lead to goals. And, you know, say play like a man, but there's whole generations of players, you know, the Roberto Baggios and the Diego Maradonas who just found the space, the innate sense of it, and she has it.
Oh, Team USA Women's Soccer, 11 players competing in their first Olympics. You think about team chemistry, but also, you know, George, how much pressure are they facing to win the goal? I mean, it seems like the target is on their backs, and they face a huge task.
I think the U.S. is always under pressure in that sport, and the same thing with women's basketball. Of course, the American women are down there, and you look at them, how deep they are. They've just established, and you know, the United States gets all the credit in the world. I mean, not only does it have the money and the huge population for it, but by the commitment, by the Title IX rules that got the early players, the Hams and the Foudies, the college players, Michelle Akers, into playing that sport and so many other sports, the money that went into it. I mean, from generation, you as a basketball player can appreciate this, but the upgrade, the uptick in basketball. My daughter played high school basketball. She started on a team that actually had two Division I players, two young women who went on to play Division I.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, if a girl got a ball kind of hit her in the face or something and she was stunned, nine young women would stand around and see if she was all right. These days, it would be get out of my way.
Yeah.
And it's just been an upgrade in tactics and mentality year after year. So the United States now is at a point where they should win in those two sports.
The Rio 2016 Olympics, they are underway. Obviously, high hopes for Team USA as we have been zeroing in on women's soccer, going one-on-one with longtime columnist with the New York Times and best-selling author George Vesey, who has been joining us right here at the all-new SB Nation Radio. Thanks for joining us, George.
Anytime.
You bet.
Nice talking to you, Big E.
Of course. Stick around. Much more coming your way right after this quick timeout.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker Campbell.
Elissa Walker Campbell, I want to welcome you back to SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. It is. I am so excited. It's time to tee it up. And six players have shot a 59 on the PGA Tour. But you know what? No one has ever carded a 58 until last Sunday. What a memorable and historic round for Jim Furyk. He sets a tournament record 27 on the front nine. It was a special day, and we are so delighted to have back with us on our Progressive Insurance Celebrity Guest Line, that is the CEO of National Golf Schools and legendary PGA award-winning teaching professional, Patrick Livingston, who knows Jim Furyk well. Good evening.
Well, how are you doing? And boy, what a great day for Jim Furyk. And you talk about a fellow that is unassuming and goes about his business as a professional. You see Jim Furyk, by that description. And even when he was talking about the 58 at a great news conference after it, he was just talking in very normal terms. He had made this shot. He'd hold out from 136 yards on hole number six and went through it like it was a normal round of golf. It was amazing. If you or I had done that, we'd be, jumping off and up and down on the desk and telling the world.
Well, what's incredible, Patrick, is, Jim only gets better with time. Perhaps you've got the Midas touch, because I know you had a clinic with him before that round. Here he is. He's 46 years of age, and he just played his best round of golf and shoots, this record-setting 58 at the Travelers. What was going through your mind? Were you watching? Were you listening? I was listening on a PGA Tour radio.
Well, I tell you, he keeps himself in shape, which is a good thing. And he is he's a student of the game. He works on every little nuance that makes you a good player, and that that's who he is. He doesn't drive the ball that far, but he keeps it in play. He's an excellent iron player, excellent wedge player, and one of the best putters on tour. That's a great combination. He was on a course that wasn't as long as some of the monster courses out there now. He had drives that allowed him to hit higher lofted irons into the greens, and he made a lot of very good putts, and all of a sudden it was 58. Well, he's the last person to shoot 59 and the first one to shoot 58.
It's crazy.
What kind of monocle is that?
I know, and the game of golf, it can just be so fickle and wacky. It can make you just nuts because, from what I understand, Jim Furyk, when he was out on the range in the morning, warming up, he didn't have a great practice, or a great warm-up. So for him to go out and, just lights out and shoot that 27 that first nine, that's incredible.
Well, you know how bad it is? His first two rounds in a tournament, we're very disappointed with not hitting the ball very solid. And this is something he rarely ever does. He took, videotapes of his swing, sent it back to his dad, who was his one and only instructor. He analyzed it, talked to Jim about, a few subtle little adjustments in his swing, and the next day he comes out and shoots 58. That is, that's miraculous.
What adjustments do you think that he made with his swing, and perhaps what his father could have told him?
He said that his swing plane was a little bit high, so his angle coming into the ball was slightly off. All you did is, get your swing plane back into proper, perspective, and then the whole swing falls into place. And it was a small adjustment like that. And even though, Jim was a, excellent teacher, excellent pro, you cannot see that on yourself. So he had some professional eyes, in this case his dad, look at his swing. He clearly saw what adjustment needed to be made, explained that to Jim. He went out, made that little adjustment, and came out and played the best round of his life.
The CEO of National Golf Schools, Patrick Livingston, always a regular guest, right here at the all-new SB Nation Radio. You're listening to the Big E Sports Show, and I'm your host, Elissa Walker-Campbell. We are interactive. Always love to hear from all of our listeners out there and our fans. You can tweet us at eRadio Sports, and you can always email the show at info@eradiosports.com. Okay, it's interesting what you brought up. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that Jim Furyk was the last player, or to shoot a 58, because he was the last player to shoot a score of 59 back in 2013. So, yeah, looking ahead, what can we expect from Jim Furyk over the next 5 to 10 years?
I see, no reason why his game should diminish, hardly at all. Like I say, he's in good shape. When he goes to the, Champions Tour, those courses are modest distances, 64, 6,500 yards long. He'll be having short irons in his hand. He's always a good putter. If I could get Fluff off the bag, I would probably love the caddy for him.
And I think the point that I've got to bring up as well is, it's stunning that Jim Furyk was able to do this because he was out for an extended period of time with that left wrist injury, and it was a long rehab. it's inspirational. I mean, when you think about what he was able to accomplish, and now Mr. 58.
No, that's really true. That's the second, wrist injury. And, you know, the most common, injury in golf is the lower back, and that gets a lot of the, a lot of the good pros, a lot of the pros. But the wrist injury is the second most, destructive, because it does take so long to repair. I mean, he's laid off, I believe, 8-9 months the first time, and 6 or 7 months this time. And to his credit, he went through the rehab, did what he had to do, got his wrist back in shape, and got to the golf course. And what really hurts is during the time that that wrist is hurt, you can't work on your game.
Yeah.
So you're not putting that club in the ground to work on all the things you need to work on. And so you have to be, mentally tough to go through that, knowing that you could come back and get the game back to where you've had it at one time.
Okay, my final question for you tonight, Patrick, is give us your thoughts on the Rio Olympics and golf in the Olympics. Obviously, that's been very compelling to watch.
Well, of course, it's a great course. It's a it's a lengthy course, and that's fine. And the only thing that can defend it is the wind, and they'll have plenty of wind down there. But I think the four pros down there playing are having a wonderful time. They're intermingling with other athletes, going for gold in their particular events for their particular country, and they're getting that atmosphere. They don't get that in tournaments. It's pretty stoic out there on that golf course, and it's just a totally different atmosphere. And the interviews I've seen so far, they're just excited to be there and find it a totally, totally unique experience.
You've been listening to The Voice, the CEO of National Golf Schools. Check him out online, nationalgolfschools.com. He is a regular guest right here at the Big E Sports Show. That is Patrick Livingston. Thanks so much, Pat.
Great talking to you.
We'll talk to you real soon. Stick around. Much more coming your way right here at the all-new SB Nation Radio.